Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2000. Reading Armistead Maupin's prose has been compared to meeting up with a beloved old friend, an encounter filled with warmth, wisdom, and familiar touches of humor. No wonder he has such a huge readership. He works his dialogue with a jeweler's precision and a playwright's development of dramatic irony, wrote a critic in the Times Literary Supplement. It was in San Francisco that Maupin's Tales of the City was born. Beginning in 1976, they were serialized as weekly columns in the San Francisco Chronicle, and shortly thereafter came to the attention of editor Harvey Ginsberg at Harper & Row, who wrote Maupin a letter saying, "Send me some Xeroxes. I think there may be a book here." In fact, there were six books published between 1978 and 1989, which now have a combined imprint total of 3 million copies worldwide. Film versions of Tales of the City and More Tales of the City have been broadcast to great acclaim on PBS and Showtime. Further Tales of the City is currently in production. Maupin was born in Washington, D.C. and grew up in Raleigh. He's a former naval officer and served in Vietnam. Here's one to surprise you. He once worked as a news writer for Jesse Helms. "So you can see what difference California made in my life," he has commented. Maupin's new work, The Night Listener, is a tale of spellbinding suspense. Its central character, Gabriel Noon, is a writer whose cult hit radio serial, Noon at Night, has brought him into the homes of millions of listeners across the nation. "I've written this book," says Maupin, "in such a way that I hope people will read it a second time and see and catch a whole new level of meaning. It's a meditation about the power of voices." Please welcome Armistead Maupin.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. The single question I get asked most about The Night Listener is whether or not it's an autobiographical work. Nobody asked me that on my last novel, Maybe the Moon, which was about a 31-inch heterosexual female Jewish dwarf. I could be really autobiographical in that novel, and nobody noticed. I had the perfect disguise. The central character of The Night Listener does bear a certain resemblance to me, so I have to carry a little more responsibility in that regard. And I really don't know the answer to that question about what is autobiographical and what isn't. I learned a long time ago that my most effective writing occurs when I'm reflecting on my own experience, when I'm speaking to some emotional truth of my own that I can impart to another character. I did this all through Tales of the City. And at one point or another, I was every character in that novel. People in the old days used to ask me if I knew those people. Well, of course I knew them. They were all pieces of me. And sometimes they're pieces of people I know. I listen very carefully. People tell me stories. I file them away. I always remember that line from Slouching Towards Bethlehem, Joan Didion's wonderful book, in which she says, "A writer is always selling someone out." And there is a certain sense of guilt you feel over this. But the truth is, when you're given material, when it lands in your lap, it's sometimes irresistible. The most dramatic example of this I can think of occurred when I was writing Maybe the Moon. My partner Terry and I had a house in New Zealand at the time. And I was often on the phone to my sister back in North Carolina. We're very close. And she tells me everything, poor thing. And she shared with me a story about her mother-in-law, a woman who is best described as a sort of steel magnolia from North Carolina. It seems that that this woman, throughout the course of, I suppose what we should call her gynecological career, never went to the gynecologist without first taking a bag with her to wear on her head during the cervical examinations. The theory was that her dignity would not be compromised if she didn't actually see the doctor while he was looking at her. Well, once my sister told me about this, I completely fixated on that bag. I really wanted to know, you know, everything there was to know about it. I said, was it a different bag every time? Did she stop off on the Piggly Wiggly, you know, on her way to the gynecologist? Or did maybe she have something special that she had made for the occasion, you know, embroidered perhaps, a sort of head cozy, you know? Well, I speculated. My sister told me upon penalty of death that I was not to betray her and use this material in any way. Well, I mean, it was just irresistible. So I ascribed it to the aunt of Cadence Roth, the central character of Maybe the Moon, and figured, well, I won't get caught, really. You know, there's no way this could backfire on me. And then I realized that it was the most popular section that I read from on the tour. And I had been doing just this, traveling around the country, reading from my work. And at the last minute, there was a rerouting that sent me through Raleigh, North Carolina, my hometown. And I realized that not only was my sister going to be in the audience, but she would be in attendance with her mother-in-law. So I decided, well, I wrote it. I put it in there. I can't be ashamed of it. I'm just going to have to go ahead and read it. So I read that passage, squinting out into the darkness, trying to figure out where my sister was. I couldn't spot her, but afterwards I did find her, and I pulled her aside, and I said, well, how was it? How did it go? And my sister said, oh, fine. When you got to that point, she just leaned forward and whispered in my ear, you see, somebody else does it too. So there you have, in a nutshell, I think, why readers read and why writers write, for that proof that somebody else does it too, for the validation of our lives. That's certainly why I write, and I have found in the past that the times when I got closest to my own experience, when I told the things about myself that I was most embarrassed about, that I, in the process of admitting those things, came closer to the people I was writing for, came closer to the readers. People would come to me and say, I never knew anybody else felt that way. As Louise explained to you, the earlier in her remarks, the novel is at its core a mystery story, a sort of psychological suspense story. It was my effort at creating something like Vertigo, a work of art that has had a huge influence on me over the years, ever since I was 14 years old and saw it. I love it even more now that I'm the age of Jimmy Stewart in that movie and really understand what's going on in it. The central mystery involving Gabriel Noon and a 13-year-old boy that he strikes up a conversation with, I won't go into because I want you to discover it on its own. A lot of the early reviews have been have tended to give away far too much of the story, and this novel is constructed to give you a series of surprises as you read it that will keep you reading. What I will read from tonight is several sections that have to do with Gabriel's own history. When I was a boy, people often mistook me for my mother on the phone. Ladies from the Colonial Dames or St. Michael's Church would call the house on Meeting Street and chirp, "Good morning, Laura," as soon as they heard my boyish soprano. But I was only mildly offended, since my mother was a celebrity of sorts, the moderator of a weekly panel discussion on WUTF radio, whose call letters stood for We Uphold the Family. Mummy's show was called Time for Teens, and her four panelists were all of high school age, big worldly kids with big worldly problems to discuss, like the treatment of acne and whether necking would inevitably lead to more serious things, like petting. While it was just a public affairs project for the Junior League, the show was so well received that older kids sometimes asked me if I had a sister named Laura. And once Mummy even posed for a picture that appeared on the front page of the News and Courier. She and her panelists were caught sipping soda in a booth at Hoffman's Pharmacy, their straws thrust rakishly into the same glass. My mother's parents were British immigrants, and she clung to her roots with a vengeance, as if to remind snobby little Charleston that she'd come from a far more cultivated milieu. This was why her children were instructed to call her Mummy, though I rarely used the name in public after the age of 8. It made me sound too much like little Lord Fauntleroy, and my mother like an Egyptian artifact. This flaunting of all things English reached its fullest flower when Mummy was chosen to play Eliza Doolittle in the Dock Street Theater's 1954 production of Pygmalion. She spent hours at home running lines with me and practicing her Cockney, which, I've since come to realize, consisted of little more than dropping her H's. But I was so impressed that I studied her technique carefully and inflicted my own strangled Cockney upon friends, as if it were some new form of Pig Latin. And I remember what it was like at home on rehearsal nights when Mummy would leave a casserole in the fridge, or pay our maid, Lottie, to stay after work and fix us her fried chicken. My father would sulk in his den, his face buried in the latest tome on the Civil War. "Your mother's off at the theater," he would mutter, "with the fairies." He was desolate without her, an orphaned wretch, even with three children in the house. If you'd known my mother, you'd understand. She was lovely to begin with, in a creamy-skinned, hazel-eyed Deborah Carr kind of way. And she was such a light, such a beam of pure compassion, that darkness of any sort, even my father's stubborn variety, didn't stand a chance in her presence. Drawn to strays of any kind, she was a pillar of the SPCA, but she rescued a number of humans as well, or attempted to, over the years. I came to refer to them as the refugees, since for some reason they were usually European, perhaps because it offered Mummy the illusion of a larger world. The refugees were divorcees, or in the process of becoming, vaguely scarlet women who had met their American husbands at military bases overseas. Lured to the Low Country by the promise of true love and Tara-like plantations, they ended up in trailer parks and tract houses, married to some abusive Bible-spouting dickhead whose name seemed always to begin with O, an Orville or an Olin or an Otis. It was my mother's mission, she believed, to pry these women from their personal hells, to offer comfort in conversation, to find them suitable mates among the well-bred bachelors of the yacht club. She rarely succeeded. More often than not, she landed smack dab in the middle of some knockdown, drag-out marital fracas. "Your mother's lost her goddamn mind," my father once reported. "She's hiding in a phone booth at a motel in Ravenel, and she won't come home until Veronique comes out." Exactly why Mummy was hiding, or what her refugee was doing inside, I was never told. But my father did volunteer that Veronique was common as pig's tracks, and that my mother would end up in a serious lawsuit if she didn't mind her own goddamn business. I waited for all hell to break loose, but Mummy returned that evening into time to take her pot roast out of the oven and settle in for the Bob Cummings show. As she snuggled up to my father on the sofa, all that betrayed her busy afternoon of espionage was the cryptic little half-smile blooming on her face. In later years, Mummy's caretaking was more confined to home. My father's mother, the grandmother we called Dodie, had Parkinson's disease and the beginnings of Alzheimer's, though we thought of it then as garden variety senility. Dodie was shaky and bent over, a human parenthesis with a hearing aid as big as a prayer book hitched to her bosom. She needed help getting out of chairs and going to the toilet and even walking, all of which services my mother provided with unending goodwill. As the two of them inched across a room together, Dodie, who had strived for gentility all her life, could sometimes be heard to emit a barrage of unladylike farts. "Oh, goodness me," she would murmur in mortification, and Mummy would squeeze Dodie's shoulder and say, "That's all right, we'll just hurry and get away from it." Dodie's failing mind sometimes fell prey to demons. When I was in my early teens, she became convinced she was being investigated by St. Michael's Church, by the ladies' auxiliary, no less. "They think I'm an alcoholic," I heard her tell my parents one night. And even then, I guess that this delusional nonsense was really about my grandfather and the firestorm of speculation that Dodie must have endured after his suicide. I had come across a bundle of old letters in the attic several years earlier, proclamations from local civic organizations extolling the virtues of the first Gabriel Noon upon his untimely death. Though they all avoided the particulars, there was a note of anxious overstatement to them that invited suspicion even before I knew how my grandfather had died. In its concerted effort to remove the shame, the town had merely made it official, and Dodie had borne it for almost a quarter of a century. I remember passing her room late one night and hearing a sound that rattled me to the core. At 75, she was whimpering in her sleep like a baby, curled up there in the big mahogany sleigh bed that her grandfather's slaves had built. My mother took care of everyone, but her firstborn was especially blessed. When I was as young as 8, she would bring me breakfast in bed on Saturday morning so I could listen to Big John and Sparky in the alpine lair of my upper bunk. My father, who complained bitterly of her mollycoddling, had contributed to this indulgence by building a shelf near the ceiling that could hold both my shortwave radio and my vast collection of Hardy Boys books. Later, when I discovered the Big Show and its host, Miss Tallulah Bankhead, I would climb to my eyrie after supper and surrender to the smoky, warm, mannish voice of a woman I worshipped as a goddess but had never actually seen. In Mummy's version of things, I was simply her eccentric child. My brother Billy was the athletic, methodical one, the natural heir to my father's gift for finance, a lively, uncomplicated kid who spent hours moving marbles across the rug as if they were beads on an abacus. And Josie, by definition, was the precious little girl, a role so exalted that no one could imagine a future for her beyond marriage and motherhood. Of the three children, I was the puzzlement, the one my mother dubbed Ferdinand, since, unlike the other little bulls, I preferred to sit alone in the pasture and smell the flowers. How could she not have known from the beginning? She must have suspected something when I saw Singin' in the Rain 8 times at the age of 10, when I entered my homemade vegetable dyes in the junior high science fair, when I spent weeks designing a stained glass window for my bedroom. "Gabriel is just naturally creative," Mummy would tell her friends when Pap wasn't there to hear it. "One day he'll write a scandalous book that will embarrass the whole family, just the way Tom Wolfe did." My mother had grown up in Asheville when Wolfe was wreaking havoc there with Look Homeward, Angel. She recalled the way the author's family had dined out for years on their literary notoriety. Old Mrs. Wolfe had always been ready with a stock reply when asked how it felt to have her dirty laundry aired in public. Drawing herself up grandly, she would proclaim with a stoic sigh that Caesar had Brutus and Jesus had Judas and we have our Tom. But Wolfe was permitted his indiscretion, Mummy said, because he was a genius and a true bohemian. He had run off to the north, you see, and moved in with a Jewess who was much older than he was. You couldn't get any more bohemian than that, she said with a knowing look, as if to suggest that there might be a Jewess or two in my own future. Though she played by the rules of Charleston society, my mother herself nursed private dreams of bohemianism. Her own mother had been an ardent suffragist in England, and it was still known to read palms and cite the theosophy of Madame Blavatsky. So Mummy would often make reference to karma and rosy circles and past lives without fully knowing what those things were, and certainly without abandoning her weekly Episcopal prayer group. But I wanted her to be Annie Mame as much as she did, so I egged her on at every turn. We went flea marketing together and bought exotic Indian cotton bedspreads for the house. Once, in a rare display of physicality, I completely rearranged the living room to showcase more dramatically her fine collection of blue Pisgah Mountain pottery. There were, though, limits to my mother's nonconformism, and I discovered them when I made friends with Rusty Ellis. Rusty, to my mind, was a perfectly prosaic kid from Minneapolis whose father had recently been transferred to an insurance company in Charleston. True, the Ellises were somewhat disrespectful of the South, and their living room furniture was all Danish modern, but I really liked knowing someone who said Davenport instead of sofa. And Rusty's love of the movies was easily the equal of mine. Also like me, he had successfully made it to 14 without learning the rules of a single sport. We spent our time together after school discussing the deeper meaning of vertigo, or searching for the tomb of the real-life Annabel Lee, a local girl the young Edgar Allan Poe had once courted out on Sullivan's Island. I was already jerking off at that point, but I felt nothing like lust for Rusty. I was just extremely comfortable around him. I had stumbled by chance upon a member of my own tribe, and Mummy must have realized this long before I did. She liked Rusty just fine, for the very reason she liked me, but two fey little fantasists was one too many for her comfort. She pulled me aside one day and suggested gently that maybe I shouldn't see so much of my friend. When I asked her why, she said that Rusty was a little effeminate, through no fault of his own, of course, but it might cause people to think things. And I realized then that my secret deficiency wasn't just happening in my pants. It was part and parcel of my very being, a blazing scarlet H that could easily betray me at any moment. That's okay. There's more. My mother carried my secret long before I knew that she knew. Her early suspicions were confirmed by a girlfriend of mine, a friend, really, nothing more, who had flown out to San Francisco in the preposterous belief that I had seen the light and was ready to propose. All I'd wanted, in fact, was a generous listener, someone from home to witness my fledgling joy, to hear about this handsome doctor I'd met, this stalwart professional that even Pap would find acceptable. Becky Ravenel listened all right, her mouth slightly agape, pausing only to slip a Valium from her purse and gobble it dry like an after-dinner mint. The next day, when I was off at the radio station writing ads for waterbeds and singles bars, she phoned Charleston to break the news to the mother-in-law she would never have. Mummy, mind you, never told me this. She harbored the knowledge for 3 or 4 years as a malignancy grew in her breast. She wasn't shocked, she told Josie later, but she was worried about the way the world would treat me and the life I'd lead. Maybe it seemed all right now when I was young and reckless, but what would it be like when I was older? When I was 50, say, and lonely and childless? She was just as worried about my father, resolving to keep the news from him at any cost, knowing how it would destroy him. But she did her best to educate herself, spending hours in the stacks of the Charleston Library, furtively reading books she was too ashamed to check out. I didn't tell them until 3 years later, and didn't really tell them then. I had one of my characters do it. Will Devereaux wrote a letter to his parents that was plainly intended for mine. My radio stories weren't broadcast nationally then, but I was mailing tapes to my folks every week, so even a blind man could read the semaphore. And Will was as forthcoming as I'd always wanted to be. He wrote of the relief he felt upon finally being himself. He wrote of his love for his parents and how he refused to dishonor it with secrets. He told them not to worry who had made him that way, because it was what he was meant to be, and because, above all, he was happy. Such declarations weren't commonplace on the radio a quarter of a century ago, so the letter attracted attention. Newsweek did its first piece on Noon at Night, identifying me as a gay storyteller in the process. Passive as ever, I waited for the mushroom cloud to appear over Charleston, or at least an anxious phone call from my mother when the old man was at work. But there was nothing for almost a month. Then a letter arrived, a single paragraph scribbled on a sheet of bank stationery. Dear Gabriel, as you know, your mother is very ill. Any additional stress can only cause her condition to deteriorate. Please try to remember that and act accordingly. Pap. For all its stiffness, the message was clear enough. I was killing my mother with my selfish exhibitionism. I could only guess about the scene at home, the ranting and raving my mother must have endured, i.e. the additional stress for which I alone was responsible. Had I known then how long she had protected me, I would have gone home and faced the consequences. I should have done that anyway, I know, but I just didn't have the strength. And I told myself that my father, beneath all that sound and fury, wasn't strong enough to handle it either. So I turned my attention elsewhere. It was fun, after all, to be young and randy with only a reputation for outrageousness to uphold. I could swing from the radio station to the glory holes and back again on my lunch hour, sharing my exploits with flabbergasted co-workers, and feel righteously political in the process. There was nothing I wouldn't tell the truth about. I am faggot, hear me roar. If my family didn't want me, I would build a family of my friends and lovers, and to hell with anyone who couldn't cope. I puffed myself up the way I'd seen my father do when railing against the communist menace or the scourge of integration. And though I meant every word of it, my zealotry served as a convenient distraction, a shield against the unthinkable loss that lay ahead. For a while, it was easy to believe that Mummy would survive. I wasn't there, after all, for most of it. I didn't watch the slow draining of her spirit, the daily indignities that would add up to death. Even in catastrophe, she was her usual selfless self, downplaying her pain for others and turning sassy when her options dwindled. After her mastectomy, she granted an interview with the News and Courier in which she talked breezily about having the big C, an homage to John Wayne that pleased my father no end. Privately, she was fond of telling her lady friends, in her bravest impersonation of Auntie Mame, that the only adequate compensation for having a breast removed was having the other one tattooed. Meanwhile, she got her house in order. She called me one night to say that she wanted me to have Dodie's bed, that big mahogany sleigh bed built by her grandfather's slaves. Billy and Josie had already received family things as a wedding present, she said, so it was only fair that I get something nice, since I would never be married. That her blessing came in the shape of a bed wasn't lost on me. I cried the day it arrived, seeing its familiar dents and the little sack of hand-wrought bolts that my father had labeled with a felt-tip pen. And I cried when I first shared that bed with someone else, lying against him in its curvy embrace, knowing that my mother, with her signal sense of theater, had imagined such a scene. When the time came, it was Josie who told me to come home. As the female nearest Mummy, she had been entrusted with the grunt work of dying, the messy specifics from which the men, myself included, had been unfailingly protected. Arriving at the hospital on a scented spring night, I found my father pacing the corridor in a state of hearty denial, assuring anyone who'd listen that Laura was going to be fine, that the doctors were just overreacting as usual. He looked so tired and terrified that I wanted to put my arms around him, but I knew it would be too much for us both. My mother's ashen face surprised me in a way I hadn't expected. Maybe because of the morphine, or maybe not, she wore an air of serene authority that made her seem like someone else. She held audiences with us all afternoon, individually at first, then with groups, though she asked me to repel several of our relatives. She had endured them for too long, she told me, and she felt no call to do so on this day that was completely hers. Her instructions were as precise as a shopping list. She wanted to look pretty, she said, so she asked my sister to paint her fingernails and specified which of the ladies at her beauty salon should do her hair for the big day. Josie was also to find a nice traveling companion for my father, though my mother was adamant that Suki Newton, a local widow with a sharkish glint in her eye, be kept away at any cost. And she told Josie to stay closer to me than ever, since I would need her support in the years to come. When my turn came, Mummy greeted me with a parlor trick. Seeing me in the doorway, she poked a foot out from under the sheets and splayed her toes in a most unladylike fashion, wriggling them as freely as if they were fingers. She had always been able to do that, she claimed, with a note of pride in her voice. She had done it the day I was born, in fact, to the amusement of the nurses on the maternity ward. I'd never known about this talent, and it stunned me to think that she'd saved something for the very end that could draw us back to the very beginning, when we were first alone together in a hospital room. I laughed and grabbed her foot, ostensibly to stop her wiggling toes, but really to embrace her, and I held on to her foot the whole time we talked, feeling it curl naturally into my hand, as smooth and cool as a seashell. And her instructions? This is what I remember. She told me to write a sweet book someday, by which she meant one that wasn't dirty. Something like The Snow Goose, she said, that would lift people's hearts. She told me to go easy on Pap, since given time he would see the light. Just as I was leaving and Billy and Susan were arriving, she told me to come back early in the morning because there was someone she wanted me to meet. She had a very nice orderly, she said, a man who liked Hitchcock movies and old houses, and she thought we might enjoy each other. Pap and I slept on her floor that night. At least I think we did. I've told this story so often that there may have been some bejeweling over the decades. Maybe I just meant it metaphorically back then. It's hard to imagine what we would have used for bedding. But I do know that we stayed until dawn, camped out like gypsies in defiance of the nurse's orders. My mother wasn't expected to die that night, so Billy and Josie had gone home to their kids, and the old man and I were left alone, on the floor or in chairs or somewhere, talking quietly while the patient slept. And there, against the soundtrack of my mother's labored breathing, my father said something unexpected, that he'd known I was gay, or sensed it at least, since I was a child, and that he was sorry he hadn't brought it up earlier and made life easier for me. I didn't know what to say except to thank him. Pap had never even used the word gay before, and this was closer than he'd ever come to addressing my needs. This must be how it feels, I thought, to be close to your father, to receive his love without the burden of conditions. It didn't occur to me until later, when the funeral was over and I was back in San Francisco, that the sweetest of paternal moments may have been orchestrated by the woman sleeping next to us. And sometimes I wonder if she was even asleep. Thank you very much. Okay, where's that frightening microphone? Does anybody want to step up to it and testify? I want to tell you a story while you're working up the nerve. There's a bit in The Night Listener where Gabriel Noon goes down into the Castro, the district where he shops, and his neighborhood, really, that came directly out of my own life. Actually, the real-life version of it was a little more extreme than the version that went into the novel, because I figured it wouldn't quite be believable. But at any rate, it occurred to me when I went down one day and was making my usual rounds through the Castro. I spotted this new juice bar on the street that had not been there the week before. And to my amazement, they had developed a kind of theme around it that had to do with famous gay people. And so I walked into the juice bar, and there was a sort of fresco around the wall with a row of names. And yes, I looked. And to my great relief, there I was between Oscar Wilde and Martina Navratilova. So my chest swelled with pride, and I lingered for the longest time, hoping that the young pierced person behind the counter would recognize this icon that had just walked into her midst. And there was no recognition whatsoever. In fact, all I got after I lingered for too long was someone saying, may I help you? So I figured I'd better order something, and I ordered a ginger and orange and carrot juice drink. And the woman handed me a little chit that said Joan of Arc on it. And I said, oh, is that the name of the drink? And she said, no, that's the designation for the order. You're Joan of Arc. And I said, oh, well, okay, thank you. And I sat down on a bench at the edge of the room. And moments later, this really cute little baby dyke walked into the room and went up to the counter and placed an order. And she came and sat down next to me. 30 seconds later, the woman behind the counter said, Armistead Maupin. And the baby dyke got up and got her drink. And I left completely incognito. Such is the curious nature of fame, I suppose. All right, come on. Louise, is it okay if we don't record and I just force them to talk from their seats?
Okay.
Does that make it easier? Just raise your hand. All right. I feel like Monty Hall. Come on down. There's an ancient reference.
I was wondering what kind of feedback you get from other parts of the world where your book has been distributed, like communist countries or developing countries in Africa or Asia, that sort of thing.
Haven't received any feedback from communist countries yet. Hope to. That would be nice. It's doing very well in other parts of the world. The first three Tales of the City books are all on the French paperback bestseller list right now. It's been kind of amazing what's happened over there in the last year. It took them a very long time to get a foothold over there. It's kind of a hard culture to crack into. They don't like things that aren't don't originate in that aren't French. Even if your name is Maupin. But we found a little tiny publishing house that had only published Cocteau's Livre Blanc before me. And they created a really beautiful edition that began to get a sort of cult following. And then last year we sold the paperback rights to a big house with large distribution, and it just took off like crazy. It's also about to be serialized in Japan, both in book form, where they'll be released at, I think, three-month intervals, and as a serial on the internet, which thrills me no end. The Night Listener, incidentally, was the first novel ever to be serialized on the internet in audio form prior to publication. Salon.com had a program where you could stream a different chapter every night and listen to it like an old radio serial, basically. And if you still want that experience yourself, you can buy the CD or the tape, which is me reading to you for 9 full hours. And something I really do enjoy doing. I realized that when I was 8 years old, my one instinct was to make my friends listen to my ghost stories, you know. So it's really very satisfying to have arrived at a point in my life that I can actually do that for a living. It's incredible to me. Yes.
Going back to Tales of the City, do you miss those characters, and do you ever have any idea to write about them at this point, where they would be at this point?
Well, when people ask about my continuing Tales of the City, I have to ask them, do you really want to see a bunch of 50-year-olds living together in the same apartment house with with an 80-year-old landlady taping joints to their door? I actually have remained in that universe to a certain degree. There is a character in The Night Listener who was born in Tales of the City. She's 22 years old now, and she's working as a bookkeeper for Gabriel Noon. So the character who sort of resembles me has interactions with a woman who was actually a character in Tales of the City as a child. I don't want to tell you who, because I want you to discover it when you read the novel. So I've never quite left that world. There were several characters in Maybe the Moon that had minor roles in Tales of the City. I do miss the characters to a certain degree, but I feel like I have my hand in at all times because I'm involved in the writing of the miniseries. I actually know the people who play these characters now. They've become part of my own extended family, and I relate to them the way I would relate to them if I were living at Barbary Lane and knew them there. It's an amazing experience. And this last year, I collaborated with Jake Heggie, a composer in San Francisco who just finished collaborating with Terrence McNally on the opera version of Dead Man Walking. And together, we did a piece called Anna Magical Remembers, which is a monologue from the landlady of 28 Barbary Lane at the age of 80, looking back on a life that she has spent half as a woman and half as a man. The great mezzo-soprano Frederica von Stada has been performing this around the country with the classical choral ensemble Chanticleer this fall. It's a beautiful piece. If you get a chance to hear it, it's a really lovely thing to experience. Anna Magical Remembers. Chanticleer will be releasing the CD sometime this year with Flicka von Stada. Flicka, as we call her. She's a wonderful, earthy, down-to-earth, lovely person, and she was perfect for Anna. When she first came out in concert to do this and had all the right drag on, the audience just burst into applause because they recognized what she was doing right away. But as for returning to the series, I don't see that ever happening. I cannot bring myself to write Tales of the City, The Next Generation. I'm sure I would not get that right at all.
Here's a question over here. Right there.
Where is it? Yes.
I'm in the process of writing a book about some of my experiences during World War II. It's going to be called Don't Ask, Don't Tell, The Other Side of the War. Do you think that might be a popular book?
Well, it depends on what you're not asking and not telling. Do you have good stories?
It's going to be lurid.
Good. That's what we were all hoping for.
I'm one of the few people I know who spent 13 months in the Fiji Islands, 13 months in Italy, 6 months in North Africa, 6 months in Austria, and too damn long in Mississippi. And there were many lurid adventures in all of those different places.
Are you telling me you're a gay veteran, sir? Is that what we're saying here?
No, I'm bisexual.
Okay, even better.
I had
twice as many stories.
I had two wives and I have two sons.
I say keep writing.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing, as we say, in Northern California.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for all your great stories that have touched, I'm sure, many hearts in this audience.
Thank you.
When I first moved to San Francisco in 1985 from the Midwest, I read your books and made notes and hunted down a lot of the places that you made reference to and found my way around the city through your books. I think I was probably a little bit Michael, a little bit Marianne.
Well, I'll see.
But my favorite character was always Mrs. Madrigal. And I was curious when you said earlier that all the characters in the book were a little bit you. Mm. And who are you in Mrs. Madrigal?
Well, that's very interesting that you asked that. She wasn't much of me when I first started writing her. She was a kind of exotic bird. She was a combination of several things. First of all, my British grandmother, who's mentioned a little bit here in the reading I just gave you, the one that was into Madame Blavatsky. She read palms and had these enormous picture hats, dressed all in beige. She even dyed her hair something that was called champagne beige, and was an amazing woman. She was the first person to tell me that my true self was the most attractive face that I could present to the world, even before she knew what my true self was. I adored her, and I tried to get some of her spirit into Anna Madrigal. I also met a person when I first arrived in San Francisco who was taking part in a benefit. She was the subject of the benefit. Her name was Kate Marlowe. She had been Kenneth Marlowe. She was throwing a big sort of swing dance party to raise money to pay for her boob job. And she had hired Sally Rand, the famous fan dancer from the 30s, to dance. Now, this was 1972, and Sally Rand was 70 years old. She was dancing under a 3-watt blue bulb. And she looked pretty damn good. And afterwards, I went out to dinner with Kate Marlowe and Sally Rand, We stopped in front of a stained glass window down on the side of Russian Hill. We were walking around town, around the area, and I was showing her the things that I really loved about the neighborhood. And there was a big house there that had a beautiful stained glass window that had a knight and a damsel and a whole sort of romantic scene. And Sally Rand stood there and looked at it, and she says, "It was lovely in the olden days, wasn't it? Fucking hadn't even been invented." Anyway, why don't I get on that, for heaven's sake? Kate Marlowe told me that she had been raised in Winnemucca, Nevada, that her mother had run a whorehouse, and that she had grown up being friends, as a little boy, had played in the living room of the whorehouse with all these whores as her sort of surrogate aunts. And I thought that was just a fascinating story, and I incorporated it as part of Anna's history. Several years later, I was in another town somewhere, and I saw a self-published autobiography by Kate Marlowe in which she explained in vivid detail how her parents had been a Chicago gangster and his mall. So apparently she was as good a storyteller as I was. And so the question that you pose is whether or not Anna was any part of me. She really wasn't. She was the one I felt separate from then. Now she's the one that I like to write for the most, for several reasons. For one, she's being played by the great Olympia Dukakis. Olympia and I are terrific buddies, and we'll sit and talk about the character and where she's going. And Olympia always wants to give her a little more of that sort of Greek pain, you know. And it's always, in the book, I think Anna's a little more fey and flighty than she is on the screen, and Olympia's really rooted her in something quite real, and she stopped to try to figure out what Anna's all about. She could have played her as a woman. She could have said, "Well, Anna used to be a man, but now she's a woman. I'm a woman. There's nothing I have to do." Olympia went out and hired a transsexual consultant and spent a week with her talking to this woman about her life and the journey she'd made. And at one point, she grilled her and said, "This is obviously a traumatic experience. It's a physical and emotional trauma. It's expensive. You do it in the face of society not understanding at all. Why did you do it? Why did you want to become a woman?" And this woman replied, "I wanted the friendship of women." And I was very moved when I heard that. It was as if, I mean, she was saying basically, as a man, she loved women, but she never felt she could be as close to women as she could as being another woman. She would not have the bond of that kind of a friendship. And I thought that was such a lovely thing to say that I actually built it in to Anna's dialogue. And that's happened a lot with that character. I've built my own sort of middle-aged wisdom, if you will, into Anna. I'm the age that Anna was when Tales of the City began. So she's really the only one I've grown into, which is not to say that I'll be leaving for Denmark tomorrow. I like being a man. Yes.
Thank you very much. This is just a terrific, terrific evening and a very moving reading. I wanted to ask you if you can tell us what your next project is.
I haven't the slightest idea, and I'm really happy about that. I really enjoy the notion of having a clean slate ahead of me. All of my novels arise out of this compulsion to write. When the time arises, I think, I have to say this, I have to tell that story. I have to take the characters in this direction. And I'm not sure what the next one's going to be. And I'm not one of those driven writers who has to get up and write every day. The gentleman that's taking me around L.A. here, well, I shouldn't say that, Bob. Well, should I? It's like betraying the confidence of another writer. No, she'd be proud to have it known, I guess. He said when he took Joyce Carol Oates around Los Angeles that she sat in the back seat and wrote the whole time, which is the only explanation for how she manages to write a book of some sort every 6 months. It's quite clearly a pathology, I think. I don't have that sickness. I'm very insecure about what I do, so I have to really care about the story I'm about to tell. And I have to feel that I haven't told it before. That was one of the reasons that I ended Tales of the City. I was afraid I might start repeating myself, and I could see a shape that had happened in the course of writing it. It began with Marianne's arrival, and it ended with her leaving, and it all sort of made sense. And when the end came, it was quite logical to me. The next thing I do may be an original screenplay. That's kind of what I'm thinking I'd like to do right now, but I don't know.
Thank you for this evening. And what was the first piece of literature that you sold?
That I sold?
Mm-hmm.
Tales of the City. And basically, I sold the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, on the idea of letting me write fiction in a daily newspaper. So it was a wonderful impetus. I actually had a reporter's salary to write fiction, and I might never have... The critic in me might have stopped me long before if I hadn't simply been required to write it. I had to do 800 words a day, come hell or high water, and I didn't have time to stop and say, oh, this isn't good, or I'm not on the right track here, or I'll never get this right. I had to do it. And I got some feedback from my public. That's the great part about it. I recommend it for anybody who wants to start off, who wants to write and wants their fiction noticed. Find some periodical where you can get your words in print, which is very encouraging in and of itself. Just seeing your own name in print makes you feel more like a writer than anything else in the beginning. And so I basically got a contract from the Chronicle to write fiction as if I were writing, as if I were working as a reporter. I really didn't sell anything before then. And I've been with the same publishing house all along as well, because it became very clear that I should keep all my eggs in one basket if I was going to be telling the same story for 6 novels. I didn't know that in the beginning, of course. I didn't know there was one novel in what I was doing. But the process of having to write really taught me more than I ever would have learned if I'd been sitting at home trying to finish a novel before I submitted it.
I have a question. There's often time. Can you hear me? Okay. There's oftentimes criticism from some members of the gay and lesbian community anytime a gay character in either in a movie or television or a book resembles in any way a stereotype of gay men or gay women. And I'm wondering, I'm thinking specifically the central character in Torch Song Trilogy, for example. I'm wondering if at the time that you first started publishing, if you ever received any organized approach or vocal opposition from members of the gay and lesbian community who wanted you to tone down any of the characters that had any kind of resemblance to a stereotype, particularly of the mid-80s, using the poppers or having anonymous and active sex life. Did you ever encounter any
of
that?
Is that a stereotype?
Oh, sure.
I don't know what that means anymore. I do know, I mean, I know what you're talking about, and I've seen films where there's this pathetic cartoon character we've all have for many years. Harvey Fierstein in Torch Song Trilogy is simply being Harvey Fierstein. I think he'd be shocked to hear that he was a stereotype. I mean, he's a particular kind of person, but he's his own creation, too. I mean, I have huge admiration for him and for that work. No, I haven't had anybody try to tell me that, and I really resist the notion of the thought police coming in and telling anybody how to write. My feeling is that we should all tell our own stories the best way we can and get on with it. And I think that's happening now because there are out-of-the-closet writers and agents and producers who want to see these stories told honestly. But I don't have any need whatsoever to be PC about my life or anybody else's life. There might have been a time when I would sit around and worry about what people thought, but I don't do that anymore. I believe myself to be worthy of my existence. And I believe other gay people to be worthy of it as well. And we have nothing to prove to anybody, except perhaps our humanity, and we can simply do that by talking about our lives. I think it's the foibles of my characters that make them good ambassadors, if you will. I think that's why the series has been successful, because these are not perfect people, none of them, straight or gay. So I guess that's an answer. Yes.
Hi. When did you first start writing, and were there any particular people or writers who inspired you?
The biggest inspiration in my life, both in literary and a personal sense, was the writer Christopher Isherwood, who lived here for many, many years out in Santa Monica Canyon. I would like to tell you in a serious literary fashion that I'd read all his work from an early age, but the truth is that I discovered him through Liza Minnelli in Cabaret. But I loved that film so much that I had to find out what the real story was about, and I went out and bought the Berlin stories and discovered this man with this remarkable voice who spoke with great clarity and with a self-effacing quality that I found tremendously appealing. And then I discovered his novel, A Single Man, an amazing work of art that still to this day is one of the best things ever written about a gay person. And I was very lucky because I met Chris and his partner of many years, Don Bacardi, at an Oscar night party in L.A. At the home of one of the producers of Saturday Night Fever. That should sort of place it in time for you. And when I went up to Chris and sort of in a very stumbling way told him that he was such an inspiration to me, both he and Don, because they had been a visible gay couple in Los Angeles for years and years. When Chris and Don met, Chris was 48 and Don was 18 and looked 13. So they were a scandal. And yet they held their heads up. They were this example of a loving couple who lived a free and wonderful life. And it was an amazing inspiration to a lot of people of my generation. And Chris, to my amazement, had actually read a few episodes of Tales of the City in the Chronicle, and liked it, and told me so, and came to San Francisco on a speaking tour and acknowledged me from the stage, telling the audience that my work reminded him of Dickens. So it felt really great at a time when I needed that kind of a boost. And I remember even at one point saying, trying to express my gratitude to him, and he said, "Oh, don't worry about it. You know, Somerset Maugham did the same thing for me." And it thereby linking me in the most extraordinary way to this great tradition of queer literature in the 20th century. So he made a big difference in my life, and I treasured our friendship. He was, and I think about him and Don all the time. But Don remains one of my best friends and a great inspiration to me in terms of his amazing self-discipline, the way he works every day. He makes entries in his diary and he paints a different person every day. So Chris was the big force for me. And I remember, the older I get, the more I think about the way he behaved, and I remind myself how he remained in the moment, how charming he was, how he didn't dwell on his past. He loved every day as it came up. Yes, Tim?
Armistead. Hey, how you
sweetie.
Doing? Hi. I wanted to follow up just the question before that. When you talked about the humanness of your characters as ambassadors of queerness in a way, which is to me one of the deepest ways I've always related to your work. And during your reading, the kind of echo, in a way, in the new book, The Night Listener, of Mouse's letter to his parents during the horrors of Anita Bryant. And sadly, a time which I'm starting to feel I'm thinking of a lot right now as we face this election and what I fear may be a very scary time. So I'd actually had read Mouse's letter about a week ago. Maybe my own memories of that time 20 years ago. But I think what I'd be kind of curious is to hear a little bit more, because for me, your work, and especially when I was reading you as a young, you know, queer artist boy in San Francisco and New York.
You're still a young
70s.
Queer artist boy.
Oh, I ain't so young! and also, you know, your characters and their voices, in a way, have reached more people probably than any other representations of what it is to be queer in the world, you know, which I think is, and their humanity is so profound and deep. And I guess I'd partly like to hear a little bit more about what we can do and how these images and our deep humanness, or even the humanness of that in the reading tonight of that father and son, that exchange of how you think those building blocks of just our humanness also connects to the a political event, like in Mouse's letter during the horribleness of Anita Bryant. It's kind of a big question, but what you touched on, I think, is such a way I deeply respond to your work, and it's a little
Thank
bit.
Thank you. That's first of all, ladies and gentlemen, this is Tim Miller, the great writer and performer. He's remarkable. I hold his work in awe. You know, Tim, for me, it's always been the whole visibility question. It's about presenting yourself honestly for who you are, for fighting every battle, as you've been doing in terms of the whole gay marriage thing, the immigration issue. It's fighting every battle in public, not retreating, and doing it in a daily way, doing it in your daily life, basically. And not being afraid of whether or not you're presenting a perfect image to anyone, but you're simply presenting a true image of who you are. That's what always startled me about Isherwood, was that he tried to be honest about himself all the time, and it made you trust him. He would say things about himself that you couldn't imagine anybody saying about themselves, and then you think, well, he must be a real purity of heart there. I don't know quite where you want me to go with this, but I've always seen, people say, oh, there have been times when people have said about my work, oh, well, you're not really a political writer. And I really cringe when somebody says that, because I think of my work as being deeply political. And I suppose it's propaganda of the sneakiest variety, because I made a rule with myself, if I ever sounded like I was getting preachy or pedantic, that I would have to find a way to show something rather than to declare it, because I think that's the most effective way you can change people's minds, is by showing not only the, you know, showing the differences and the similarities. When you say you're, are you fearful of Mr. Bush? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really bad is about to happen.
Yeah, I worry about that too, especially given the nature of the race, and given the fact that he would stand up and actually mouth those dreaded words, "special rights," which is just a signal to the lowest Neanderthals of the religious right that he's on their side. I found that completely horrifying. I remember, incidentally, when Jesse Helms used to use the term "special rights" to refer to African Americans who were looking for some kind of equal justice back in the late 60s. The very same term. That was exactly the way they fought that battle 30 years ago. By denying the thing that we all know to be true, that there is a privileged class in this country, and that they, for the most part, are white and male and Christian and heterosexual. And they don't like the notion of sharing any of that dream with anybody else. Do you want me to rant some more? What are we doing? you're such a good rabble rouser. I should just bring you up here and let you do it. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean it deeply, but also just that I think we are at a huge moment in our nation.
I think we are too. I do think I'm not. In some ways, I feel a certain confidence in terms of America has proven itself to be far more civilized than even the motion picture industry guessed that it could have been 5 years ago, and I think that has to do with. The fact that there are so many more of us who are visible to our families and friends. And so it's much harder for people who are not like us, who are not part of us, to demonize us. Because almost everybody now knows somebody in their family, or some friend that's gay, and have seen the struggles that we've gone through around AIDS in particular. I will say I've always resented that suggestion that we hear that AIDS was the thing that made gay people grow up. You know, we finally got serious when this thing happened to us, and we didn't have any sense of what families were before AIDS came along. Well, that's just complete bullshit, because I've been around for a long time now. I've been out of the closet for 25 years, and I remember when, for instance, in San Francisco, when Harvey Milk was assassinated in the late 70s, we already had in place these kind of families that people are suggesting grew out of the AIDS crisis. We knew what that was already. I hope people don't lose their... I hope there's not a complacency around what we have achieved, and that people are aware that it can be taken away fairly easily, or at least the climate of America can be changed to such a degree that people can be cowed into that kind of submission again. Anybody of my age who remembers what it was like all those years ago to live in fear of discovery, even, doesn't want to go back to that life ever again. And I get really sad when I hear that teenagers are still struggling with this. It makes me so sad. And the reason they're struggling with it is because a lot of them are being raised in families where this kind of hatred is being spoken, it's being taught, and they're doing it in the name of Christ and God. And at the same time they speak of family values, they're terrorizing their own children by not considering the possibility that they might have a little queer in the household, because almost everybody does at one point or another. It completely mystifies me that's still the last acceptable prejudice in America.
Hmm. Yes. On that note, and with many thanks for your words and your stories tonight, please join me in thanking Armistead Maupin.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.